Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I am delighted today to bring you Molly Pietramatter. She's a civil rights and voting rights lawyer working through her firm, Amend Law. But I didn't meet Molly through her legal work. I met her first through Zumba. So here, picture this. You have this tall, lanky, graceful, beautiful woman with this huge smile on her face, exuding joy and these graceful movements, and perking up the whole room in Zumba class so that no matter what's happening in the world, we can feel together in something that's really fun. Mm. I love her classes.
Mm.
However, it was after that, and reading in the Beachcomber, and then talking to our mutual friend, Janie Starr, that I said, oh my gosh, this is the Molly who's worked with the Vashon school system to help protect our schools if ICE shows up on the property. Mm-hmm. So I thought, there's a story here. How does someone exude such joy in Zumba class and deal with one of the most painful subjects is out there right now? Mm-hmm. Because even as our current administration is doing so many heinous things, incalculable, there's something about the civil rights and the immigration rights impacts that are so painful because they are personal. Mm-hmm. It's lives that get impacted. And I can't read the papers without taking that to heart and feeling often devastated. So I needed to learn from Molly. And that's why I've invited her here today. And Molly, thank you so much for making time to come here and share a little bit.
Thank you,
because,
Sally.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
You know, the question, and it's a personal one as well as one that I think other listeners will be grappling with, is where do we find our resilience?
Right.
And how can our creativity and our expression in other parts of our lives give us something that allows us to continue in these really difficult times. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me to this conversation. It's been really good to think about how many ways that I am creative, and I don't focus on that, even with lawyering. Lawyering is a very creative, if you are a community lawyer, if
right.
you're there to lift up the people around you, make sure that they're provided with resources, take their lead, it is very creative in many ways. But I love that we met dancing, and and I love that you've invited me to think on this. And I have to say, I think right now, what we are experiencing is an ultimate destruction. We are experiencing destruction and chaos of our country, of the federal government, of the 22 agencies that run our federal government, of the white supremacist agenda. It's very much like South African apartheid is to destroy people of color in this country, is to destroy families, is to destroy that resilience and that that hundreds of years of resilience that people of color and other marginalized communities have built, and they've passed that down intergenerationally. We have intergenerational resilience. And so for me, the creative part is the resistance, because there is so much destruction right now. We must create.
Mm-hmm.
We must be tapped in to something inside ourselves that is creative and that that ignites our imagination, that ignites our vision, because otherwise we will go down,
right?
It's very easy right now to turn on the news every day and to fall and to say, oh my God, another executive order, another, I mean, the violation of our constitutions, our rights right now is off the charts. It's we've never been here before. And I do want to say it's a both and. There are times I go to Zumba and I go into that class and I cry. I do. I mean, I'm not teaching it, but I'll go to a class and I'll take the first 5 minutes or that song and I'll be in the back and I'll just let go and just weep. And that's important too.
It so is. I've never heard about it. I cry in Zumba too. You know, and for me, this is going to sound weird, but it can often be a meditation because there will be the movement, the catharsis. And then if I hear something in a song that stirs my heart and connects with something that I'm feeling, then there's this whole other dimension that comes in that I've never heard anybody else talk about that, you know, or admit to crying in Zumba.
I love it though. I mean, we need these safe spaces to emote, and it doesn't mean we're weak. It means we're aware. It means we're alive. It means feeling.
Totally. And to have a place to cry. I mean, I think that's like a little bit like Joanna Macy's work, where she gives people permission to bring their grief into community and not be limited to the tears, but also be accepting of them. So we can have the tears and have our open heart and have our joy.
Right.
You know, have it
all.
And
it does. And it transforms. I mean, I rarely go in and cry, but I have recently due to, you know, the Judge Boasberg's orders not being taken and the young men that have been incarcerated in the maximum security prisons in El Salvador. And it was maybe a week or two ago I came in and I just sort of cried the first 5 minutes. And then what I did is then I found my joy because we're all in that class together. Shakira's playing, everybody's shaking their booty and shimmying their shoulders. And there's this community and dance for me has always been, I mean, I made up dance routines when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Right. You know, to whatever. My mom always had music in the house. And we would just make up dance routines with friends. And I feel like that's the other thing that is being stolen and taken from us right now is that childhood joy, right?
Right.
You're a parent, you have to bring it, you know?
Right.
You're with your children and you're in their world. But as our kids get older or as we age, we can lose that childhood joy and that sense of wonder and curiosity. And I feel like dance is there for that, you know? Dance can be this sexual, sensual thing. It can be this, you know, I want to attract people with this. And it can also be this little 7-year-old girl in the kitchen dancing to Paula Abdul, you know? I mean, it doesn't, it holds so much.
It absolutely does. But and as you're speaking and I see the animation in your voice, I was thinking of this movie that I watched about, I think it's Estonia, where they had the singing revolution. And I've written a lot about how music, you know, people sing their way through impossible situations. They dance their way through impossible situations. And I think that's a really important part of change as well, to be able to say, you know, we have fun, it's good. But for people who continue to claim their own agency as creators in the face of no matter what, like, you can't take my song. And I was thinking about that recently because I also care about the arts. And I thought, oh, my God, they're coming for the Kennedy Center. They're coming for the Smithsonian. But I go, but you will not take our song. You will not take our dance. You can't. That's, you know, that creative spirit is belongs to each of us. And I'm hoping that collectively we keep it going.
Well, there's so many stories through history or just history itself that shows us in different, you know, and it's mostly been colonization, right? That has stripped people of their dance, of their language, of their drums. I mean, that's an old story enslaved people in this country taking our drums away.
Right.
That's our power, right? But there's also always a creative, I want to say repackaging, like not really repackaging, that's a horrible way to say it. But do you know capoeira, the martial art dance? So my sister's done this for, God, maybe 25 years now, a long time. And that originated, again, from enslaved people in Brazil creating what appeared to be a dance, but it really was a self-defense. It really was martial arts.
Oh, brilliant.
But again, to those in power, right, this is a performative piece. This is the way that, you know, quote, these folks that, you know, are oppressed and are less than in society are, you know, performing for a... But what people are actually teaching one another is, how do you sweep someone's legs out? How do you defend yourself? How do you do these? And it's beautiful to watch, but it truly is a martial art. It's a physical form of defense. Yeah. It's, you know, the ways that I think culturally people have always figured out, how can I continue to assert my power?
Right. I read in your bio that you've been working for civil rights since you were 15,
mm-hmm.
and you're now 48, is that right?
47.
47.
Yeah.
Somewhere I don't need to have to advance you.
I know, because my mom's exactly 30 years older than I am. So I'm like,
Why were you pulled to civil rights and then immigration rights?
Well, I was pulled to civil rights at a really young age. I didn't call it that back then. Part of it was, I was always questioning, you know, why are there homeless folks? Why are there homeless people? That was the first poem I wrote in third grade was about a homeless man. I didn't understand. And my family was not well off. Mm-hmm. And we were poor at times. My dad is an amputee. He has, he was in a motorcycle accident when he was 18 years old and lost his leg. And that's where he met my mom, because she was volunteering at the hospital. And so he was a very, even though he had this physical disability, he was and is I'm going to go do everything. I'm going to downhill ski on one leg. I'm going to figure, you know, I'm going to live this life as though I'm not disabled, in a way, and had a very strong and has a strong spirit. He also had, and I've actually been open about this with some work I was doing supporting Thunderbird addiction issues. But he also taught me, I really, you know, it's a complex relationship, my dad and I. Mm-hmm. He also was the first person, I think, that really started to teach me about power in society. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, he taught me when I was young to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And at the end of it was one nation. And he'd say, with liberty and justice for some. He'd always say that. He'd say that, Molly, because those that have money will get their justice and those that don't. And so I think because of growing up with less than, you know, and understanding that there were these caste systems with class, there were caste systems with race. I grew up in a very multiracial community, mostly Asian and Black and white.
Where were you?
In Tacoma.
In Tacoma?
Yeah,
right.
Kind of 30%.
Yeah.
And seeing, you know, outright just racism and discrimination. And I grew up Irish Catholic. But going to the church was all about, when I was young, service, about, again, working with homeless folks, making sure we're serving those that were less than, even though we were also less than. Mm-hmm. There was folks that were more vulnerable. And so at a young age, I was, like, with all of those sort of elements infused with this justice and service, and that the world was unfair and unequal and unjust, and there was a place to, there was work to be done. But it wasn't until I was 15, I went to Germany as an exchange student. And my family did not have a lot of money, so I sold so many $1 chocolate bars to all my neighbors and anyone that would. So I fundraised, and they said, if you can get half of this, we'll figure out the rest.
Yeah.
And I was an exchange student in Germany. And I visited Bergen-Belsen, Dachau. I went back with my ex-wife and visited Auschwitz-Birkenau later. And I think connecting the Holocaust to American history.
Right.
And understanding, even at that age, I knew about Dr. Martin Luther King. I knew about slavery. I knew about not very much about indigenous genocide, but I was understanding that there were these other stories in the United States that we were not being taught, you know, in public school. But I knew enough and to make those connections. And that's really when I think that diamond was formed in me to do civil rights and human rights work.
Now, you have mentioned, and you did a brilliant talk for the Unitarians, which I'll reference here because if anyone wants to learn more about you, they make their talks available online, the Vashon Unitarians. But you mentioned briefly, without going into any detail, that you had faced trauma and some abuse. In some ways, did that feed your connection to others who are suffering and teach you about resilience?
Did it feed my connection? Let me pause. Let me think about that. I think at a young age, because of going to concentration camps in Germany, I saw the immense cruelty that humans could be cruel. Mm-hmm. You know, humans could be evil and cruel. Mm-hmm. And then later in my life, when I was a target and victim of cruelty, of abuse, I mean, I would just be totally frank with you. Like, there's part of me that was like, girl, what were you thinking? You know, like, what were you thinking? that was a good relationship, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's the other part of me that that holds that younger Molly, that young 20-year-old Molly, with so much gentleness and compassion of that's where you thought you were going to get power. Mm-hmm. That's where you thought you would get your voice. Mm-hmm. And it was, I was with a person that I don't want to go into detail, but was masterful at abuse. Mm-hmm. Where I thought I was, you know, I was raised with a very strong mom. I was even a domestic violence advocate. Mm-hmm. This is bizarre, but prior to me being in that relationship.
Interesting. Yeah.
And did not see the flags because... Yeah. This person was so good at what they were doing. So that, yes, most definitely. I was, you know, and I state this in this talk, I was convicted for felony within the context of domestic violence. And I testified before the legislature for many years to pass laws that would allow people to get their voting rights back easier that were convicted of felonies. And for sure, that has only grown my, understanding of suffering. It's grown my understanding. But I don't, like, I'm really careful with, and I think it's important for, especially, like, I identify as white, I'm careful say, oh, because I've experienced this, I know what you feel like.
Yes.
Right? You know? Totally. And so that's kind of where I pause of, like, I've intentionally or maybe even unintentionally created times that have caused me suffering for sure in my life. And I have to take ownership of that. I mean, even as a victim of domestic violence, victims of domestic violence, there is still a choice to stay in that relationship. And I mean, everyone's different, but I have to own that, you know, those were my choices. Mm-hmm. I feel like my whole life has always been towards human rights. Mm-hmm. And that period was, made me really street smart. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. It made me really street smart. It made me really, really, and now it's made me trust my intuition as a woman, and it's made me strong. But it didn't, like, because I had that experience, that was not why I then went to law school. Like, I had dreams of law school prior to that experience.
Oh, interesting.
Actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in fact, part of, yeah, I won't go there, but yeah.
But it was, see, I've been thinking about that because I know a number of people who go into law out of a commitment to public service.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them will start out in rights law or in public defender, and few of them will last.
Yes.
And part of that is the humongous debt people often carry coming out of law school.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, somehow they burn out or they're just, they don't go for the duration. And you've been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
And you're going strong.
Well, I mean, to be honest, you know, I'm not always strong. I really am. And, there, I've been, you know, what I was reflecting on when you invited me to have this conversation, I was thinking, well, when did I start dancing lately? And it was because of burnout. I actually went through a professional burnout a few years ago, and I was in the middle of a lawsuit. I'd sued three counties, Yakima, Chelan, and Benton County for voter suppression. So in Washington state, as you know, we sign our ballots. Well, in 2016, Yakima County rejected a significant amount of Latino ballots. And we know what election happened in 2016. So if you had a Spanish surname, you were 10 times more likely to have your ballot rejected because of, quote, a mismatched signature. So I investigated this for several years and brought in UCLA Voting Rights Project and a private firm. And we went full steam ahead on suing the three canvassing review boards. And those are the boards that actually, they count the ballots. So and we have 39 counties in Washington state. So each county has a canvassing review board. They're made up of more or less three individuals, a county prosecutor, and two board members. And I can't remember off the top of my head, but three elected officials. And those people do determine each election. So it was a very complex and very all-encompassing. I mean, that's all I did. Just morning, noon, and night was this lawsuit. And it became far more than I could handle, you know, physically, mentally. My body was just shot. So I took a three-month leave. And it was interesting. After I took a leave, other lawyers started taking leaves, which I was actually really happy to see because we were all just fried, you know? Leave of absence.
From your project or from your firm?
Well, for them, like one woman took a year off from her firm and, you know, very high, highly respected and very sort of high ranking up on her firm. She was a partner, but she took a full year off after I took about 3 months off. But what I did was I went and belly danced. And I also went through menopause early. And so, of course, that creates its own emotional and physical transition. And I was like, I need to deal with this, like, extra weight on my stomach and my butt and, you know, and do something that celebrates this body.
Yeah.
So I left the suit for 3 months and doctor recommended. I mean, my doctor was like, you need to take a full year off. But I went and I found Maya, you know, who teaches belly dance at the athletic club, and ended up, dancing on Sundays and then performed in the open works or whatever, and then got right back into the lawsuit and really accepted fully that, you know, the lawsuit settled. And then after that, I was kind of like rubble after that. I really was. And, you know, I was not able to even fully like digest food for like 3 months. I mean, it was such an incredible amount of work that my body had just shut down, really. And the thing that I did, a girlfriend of mine was living out of the country, and she said, and I said, I can't even, like, you know, I was really just minimal functional, you know. I mean, I'm a parent, so I have to keep it together. But I wasn't able to work. I wasn't able to do things that So for a few months, she said, you just got to get yourself to the gym and take anything. I mean, it could have been swim. It could have been anything. It could have been a yoga class. And I just happened to stumble into Zumba. I mean, it was really, you know, happenstance, mm-hmm. kismet. And as soon as I walked in there, I just felt like, okay, this is easy. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just fun and celebratory and my body feels good doing it. And then, you know, I began another lawsuit after that, but it settled quickly. So I've been, dancing consistently for a couple of years now.
Wow.
And I think it has strengthened me.
Oh, it does. I mean, I think it does. But
I mean, mentally. Yeah.
But you mentioned that you do some other creative arts pursuits, don't you? You write poetry? Do you write? What else do you do?
I write songs, mostly.
Songs.
Yeah. Singer. But I don't perform them. I very rarely perform anything. I've always played guitar and wrote music.
Yeah.
And that's been part of, I think, my healing. It most definitely. It's been therapeutic. It's been healing for me. I think I've written maybe one or two actual positive songs.
Yeah.
You know, but it's cathartic. It's always, this has to come out, you know, and it needs. My partner actually this year gave me for Christmas, an opportunity. There's a man that does, I'm so bad with this stuff. Music, but you can go and get, like, make an album, mm-hmm. like a studio, like where here we are.
In a recording studio.
A recording studio, sorry. A music recording studio.
Yeah.
And he said, you need to record all these songs that you make.
Yeah.
And I'm not need, but I know it would be good for you. You know, I know it would feel good. And it would be a creative project for you to focus on this year with Trump coming into power. And I haven't done anything with it yet, but it is my... It is something that I do want to take time to put my songs down.
What fun. Yeah. I always think that creative process is sort of declaring your agency mm-hmm. to the universe. You know, you can beat me down, but I create, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what feeds your, we have these creative pastimes. Mm-hmm. Do people come to you, how do I say the question? I'm curious about resilience and how we support mm-hmm. each other to stay resilient mm-hmm. when every day mm-hmm. I'm clobbered and I want to cry, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about resilience from your own mm-hmm. life and what you've seen?
I wonder sometimes if resilience can look many different ways.
I'm sure it does.
Right? You know, so we have this idea of I'm strong. I can always be super whatever. You know, here's my persona. I'm articulate. I'm strong. I'm going to stand up for you. I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to be emotive in any way.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a form of resilience. I mean, that, you know, I don't want to swear on your, but that is that, you know, I'm at the protest. I'm at the march. I'm in front of an ICE officer right now saying, you cannot come in. I do not consent. I do not consent. You know, we have that form of resilience, mm-hmm. right? Or that power. But there's also, I think, the undercurrent, the deeper, anchored, softer resilience that for me personally, that's where it comes from. It's easy to be forceful, at least for me. I mean, it's easy to use my voice and stand up. What the challenge for me personally is to, I do a daily meditative practice, is to draw that strength from, you know, from just to speak openly spiritually, I draw strength from my ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
I draw strength from those that have passed on, some of my relatives. for people that have been generous in love, for those that have resisted colonization or assimilation in what form they did. And I call on that, those sort of guides and guardians every day to say, walk with me today. You know, mm-hmm. I'm going to, and I've worked with traditional healers and curanderas. That's honestly where I find my resilience.
Didn't you say you had trained as a curandera?
I actually did take a course, but I would never call myself that because I'm Irish. I'm more Irish pagan than curandera. But I'm in close relationship with curanderas, with two women. We're actually creating a retreat for next November for women together, four of us. And, you know, that's how I would encourage the resilience, because it's a quiet force that we need right now, because the chaos, it's the bull in the china shop, right? That's what we're seeing every day.
Right.
Or it's just sheer chaos and destruction. And even to track it will drive you crazy. Even to track every single move. And it's strategic. It is so strategic. They want people exhausted and depressed and overwhelmed and confused and all of these things. But if we can, or at least for me, you know, if I can, I can find peace of mind for 20 minutes in silence every morning and call on, you know, my spiritual strength.
Yeah, the help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And know, yeah, I might be pulled over at the side of the road at 4 o'clock crying, listening to the news.
Right.
You know, that I think we.
Yeah. Well, how do you deal? And this, I'm asking you this personally, because it's an issue for me. I don't have a problem. I mean, it hurts, but I can let my heart be broken. I can cry. But I have trouble with the anger I feel at 3 a.m. in the morning when I just think of any of these things, and I just feel like I want to boil.
Mm-hmm.
How do you work with anger? Do you feel that anger?
Yeah.
I assume you do.
Yeah.
And then how do you work with it so that it's so that it doesn't burn you?
Yeah. Right, right. That's a good one. Anger is interesting, and It's an emotion I really don't hang on to, honestly, because it does, it feels sick. It feels sick. And I'm not saying, there's so much to be rageful and angry about. And again, you know, coming out of domestic violence and trafficking, I was angry that that had been done to me. I was angry. And then I haven't talked about this, but I studied martial arts and got a black belt in Kaja Kembo and taught women self-defense. And I had terror nightmares for years after this experience, you know, and this individual would come in and into my dreams, you know, threatening to kill me or someone I loved. And of course, it was terror. It was like waking up and, you know, and then the more that I trained my body, the more that I did martial arts, the more that I became strong physically, those dreams transformed. And so he would come in and it would be like, ugh, you again. You know, I mean, the energy was gone. I didn't have any anger anymore. It was like a mosquito. And I remember it, and then the dream stopped. But the last one was kind of like I was doing dishes and he walked in and I was like, ugh. Like, I gotta get these dishes in the dishwasher. Can you, like, come back? I mean, it's literally, like, that is, you're just, like, this little annoying thing. And so I've, you know, that's how we have to be careful. Some people and energy and entities out there want us to be rageful, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was, they want a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
That's their goal.
Yeah.
But what does that do to us, right? Emotionally.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying there is a place for anger. There's definitely a place to channel it. But I don't even use anger. It's like there's a place for power. Mm-hmm. You know, I will stand up and I will defend those I love. I will use what I've learned in defense training and martial arts and hold myself with power. But that's different than anger for me.
Yeah. Although I feel like when anger can be pure, purified is not quite the word, but you know, when anger becomes in service to a higher good, then it feels like it has a place. I mean, it's the metaphor of Jesus in the temple. That was an angry act, and people have done angry acts in service to the common good. Mm-hmm. That's different than the reactive anger. That's like, let's light a few matches and see if we can get these people all, you know, sparked and burning and burning each other and all that.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think we're being played.
Yeah.
To be reactive.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but last night, you know, there are many of us that went to the detention center, the Northwest Detention Center last night, in response to, there's a gentleman, Alfredo Juarez, Lelo from Whatcom County, that is more or less a political prisoner there. I mean, and how he was arrested was in violation of the Fourth Amendment. There was no search warrant. And he's at the detention center. And, you know, there were beautiful, powerful speeches for the hour of the protest, peaceful protest, and times for us to chant, you know, free them all, or times to chant no. And that's where you draw that anger, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, there is a place, like that was the place for that. And I could bring that up in my body and say, yell no as loud as I wanted to, because we're all yelling no together, you know? Yeah. But I mean, I wake up in the middle of the night sometimes, and this goes back to dance. It's what we put in our little jars. Like, our day is full, you know, how much is going to fit in that jar? And because I've started to dance more, when I wake up in the night, I do routines of Zumba in my head.
Yeah. It's a great distraction. I mean, a lot more positive than the other.
I'm like, should I salsa there? Should I kickball change there? Oh, grapevine there, you know? I mean, we have to, find ways to remember that we are sacred beings that deserve to feel joy.
That we deserve to feel joy. Yeah. There was a picture on your LinkedIn page of a celebration that you took a child and your husband to, with a group of people with whom you had worked on some actions some years ago. I don't quite remember the scenario, but let me read what you said. You said, I was grateful that my spouse and daughter could see that it's not about a cause or ideas of justice on paper, but about individual people, individual friendships and alliances that endure far beyond the wins and losses of lawsuits. We attended the quinceañera of one of the plaintiffs the following day.
Oh, you're making me cry.
Yeah, well, I was crying.
It is. I mean, it's about personal relationships, you know. There was a witness in the voting rights case. I brought all the witnesses and built these relationships. And this young man invited us to his daughter's quinceañera.
Yeah.
And the young women that I interviewed when families were separated in Arizona. I worked in detention centers down there. And there were two also young men in the Northwest Detention Center. I was able to get released, who were seeking asylum. It's like those faces and those stories are forever, you know, part of my body and my mind and my heart.
Well, I love that because, you know, I'm the kind of person who walks around occasionally thinking, what is it to be a good human being?
Yes.
You know, and where are we at risk? Mm-hmm. And it's not just all this stuff that's happening, as horrible as it is. It's also the place where we may lose access to our hearts and sense of goodness, and things get abstracted.
Mm-hmm.
And so having those real human connections that you do the work, but you keep the personal, the human, the heart alive in it all. To me, that's part of standing up for being human, you know, in the good. And I think we're kind of at risk with some of the powers that be.
Yeah, no,
that are stripping us of more than just this horrible stuff they do. They're stripping us. They're making it seem like we can treat the other like this thing out there.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that, we're less than human, you know?
We're dehumanizing ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many different ways I want to respond to that. There's, you know, this is not a cause. I want to say that. I think that is, and that's what I've sort of said in that I didn't realize I put that on LinkedIn, but really there's such a difference. And I've worked with many, and I don't want to tear people down because everyone's giving something, but I have worked with a lot of different civil rights lawyers, and there are a few that are there for the cause, and they're there for their profile, right? I mean, really, for ego. And they may be incredible litigators. Thank God they're there, right? They're doing some work, but there is a paternalistic and hierarchical structure that is in place. They are the lawyer, the plaintiff's the plaintiff down here, the witness is over there. And that's, you know, that's the antithesis of how I've always done law, which is, I want to know, I want to be in the kitchen table with the witness. I want to sit for, if it takes hours, let's have our, you know, and if you've given me Coca-Colas and I don't drink Coke, I'm going to drink those Coca-Colas and we're going to sit here and, you know, and I'm going to be a part of your world and your environment, and I'm going to get to know you because I'm representing you. At some point, you are going to have, you're going to have your testimony in this lawsuit that's going to be forever canonized. It's going to be part of a legal record. Your great grandkids may find this and say, great grandma was a witness in this, and she wrote about her personal story being a farm worker. And, you know, I want to represent that as clearly and as best I can. I'm not coming in with, you know, I think it's about also being trauma-informed and how important for all lawyers to be trauma-informed lawyers, because we're all dealing with trauma. The only reason a lawyer is needed is because of trauma, because of something bad has happened, you know? No one calls you and says, my life's perfect, I need a lawyer, right? Yeah. There's some bad thing that has happened.
Yeah.
So, like, we all should be, you know, trauma-informed, sensitive, gentle. Take the time to really get to know those that we are representing, and see that we are so honored to for them to trust us, to want us to represent them. I've tried to approach, I do approach my work with real humility, and I've had mentors, amazing mentors that are no longer here. Joaquin Avila, I have to say his name, who was in the most humble civil rights attorney that I've ever come across, and had the greatest sense of humor, and was always in touch with his joy, and yet he transformed our country. He started state voting rights acts. He was an incredible litigator and powerful lawyer, but he also was the guy you want to just sit down and have a beer with.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't full of himself, and he didn't know all the answers, and I think that's, I know we're like I'm tangenting everywhere, but like that's the other thing right now, that we don't know all the answers, and that's an okay place to be.
Yeah,
you know it.
It's not even just okay. It is the place to be, because when we think that we know the answer, tomorrow we're going to find out that we were wrong. At least if we live the questions, we can stay on track and keep curious, you know, and keep open and keep learning, which is part of the creative process. You know, I think that's why part of why creativity, whether it's just, I mean, for me, I'm trying to learn to draw. I'm a very beginning drawer, but it's because it makes life interesting, because I I approach it with eyes that are curious.
Yes.
And it feels like that's how you approach the law and being with people.
Yes. Like, it is true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's that, like, I don't know. I mean, I know a lot of laws. I know a lot of ways that, you know, relief can be found. But I don't know what you want. And that's also, you know, like that one of the men that I worked with at the Northwest Detention Center was a persecuted ethnic minority from Russia, actually, Albanian. And he chose to return home. He did not want to go through his asylum because he saw what happens in U.S. I just call them prisons, immigration prisons. Mm-hmm. And he was on hunger strike for a long time. And he said, I don't want to move forward with asylum. I'd rather go get beat up in the streets and go back to where I was than to be here in this country institutionalized in this way.
Ouch.
And, you know, a certain different maybe kind of lawyer would have said, no, stay and fight. Get your asylum. It's going to be here. Just hang on another year or whatever. And, you know, for me, I said, I'm going to get you out of here as soon as I can. And he was deported because that was his choice. That was his agency. That's what he wanted within a month.
Mm-hmm.
And I followed up with him when he returned to Russia. And he said, I've never had the nightmares that I'm having because of being at the Northwest Detention Center, you know, and he had obviously a lot of other suffering in his life. He said, they can't stop. And I ask you to never, ever email or check in with me again, because seeing your name reminds me of what's happened.
Oh, ow.
And I respected that. And I will always, I know his name, I'll never speak it. But I mean, not here in the air, especially given where we are right now politically, but like, again, that's another moment where, like, I have to say, I don't have the answers. That's your choice. That's what you need. I wholly respect that.
Yeah,
100%. And I hope that he is safe. I hope that he is mother safe and alive right now today.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you can send them prayers or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. and that's all.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they get.
And we're and be grateful for that moment. You know, sometimes that's all we have is a moment with each other, and we just have this impermanence always. That's part of the human experience.
Yeah.
You know, so that moment was the moment that we had, and now it's gone.
But in that. In that, and sometimes occasionally in my coaching or whatever, I'll feel that where I just go, that was sacred.
There
was a human to human connection, which is part of your work, where you just feel like that's time out of time. That's the beauty of the moment. And then you hold on to those and they feed you.
And you stitch them together.
And you stitch them together.
It's true. Yeah. And maybe that's your answer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, about resilience.
It's part of it.
Right now,
sure.
Like all of us have these beautiful moments of resilience or connection. And and we're being, you know, the dark, dark clouds they're creating this collective amnesia that we're forgetting.
Yeah.
We're forgetting the connections that we actually do have as humans right now.
Well, that's why, and it sounds so, so small, but, you know, I like to go into those classes at the athletic club and ask people their names.
Yes.
You know, it's super small, but then I go, I'm doing this weird stretch and I can barely hold this weight and I'm doing this move. Next to you, who are you?
Right.
You know, and then it's just like a second of connection, but I think those seconds are precious, you know, and they work against that other tide that's dehumanizing. So what are you going to do for play this weekend?
I'm going to go roller skating.
Woo! Where's that?
There's a place my daughter went with a friend a few months ago called El Centro in Federal Way.
Uh-huh.
That's supposed to be fantastic. And my sister
wants
to go. My sister wants to take my daughter, actually, an auntie. So I hope I'm invited, actually. I might not be. But I'm gonna do some roller skating. And then tonight, I'm going to get together with some girlfriends, only one woman I know, and there's going to be many women I don't, and we are going to play games,
wow,
actual board games.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
and hopefully laugh and just be together, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll close.
What are you doing? Yes.
I'm going to go to Zumba tomorrow.
Oh, are you? Oh, I'm going to do that too. Oh, yeah. Okay. I forgot. I'm teaching that. Yes. Yeah.
I feel so blessed that I've had this time with you, because what you're doing is really significant, and I bless you and I thank you.
Right back at you. This has been fabulous.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.